I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are writer and culture critic Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar. They're both with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. From Boston, Neil Minkoff, he's a former primary care physician and contributor to National Review. He's also a healthcare consultant now. In Southern California, Gustavo Arellano, he's writer of the syndicated Ask a Mexican column and also author of Taco USA. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How are we doing?
Hey.
What's up, man?
All right. Well, let's get things started with a pretty serious story. Medical examiners confirmed that rogue cop Christopher Dorner died at the Big Bear Mountain Resort Town on Tuesday. Authorities believe Dorner killed four people before officers cornered him in a cabin there. But the story, it gets deeper than that. Michelle, could you set this up for us?
Yes, actually, we started the program by talking about this with NPR correspondent Karen Grigsby Bates, who brought us up to date on what Dorner's specific grievances was. But we wanted to get you all to sort of weigh in on this. He says that he was acting out of revenge after being fired by the LAPD. He says that he delivered what authorities believe is an authentic manifesto reportedly written by himself, and it outlines his grievances, including what he says was a culture of racism that was perpetuated not just by white officers but by, you know, officers of color as well. He also does name people who he says were supportive of him. But L.A. Police Chief Charlie Beck says that he's going to reopen the investigation into the specific event that led to Dorner's dismissal. And this is why, according to LAPD spokesman Commander Andrew Smith. Here it is.
Well, Chief was very clear when he spoke about that, and he's not opening it because of the accusations or because of the musings of someone who's a multiple murderer now. He's doing it because he wants to ensure that the public knows that the Los Angeles Police Department is fair and transparent.
Wow. Thanks for that, Michelle. Now, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I've been hearing some strange responses from people I've talked to all over the Twitterverse and on the Facebook. Gustavo, before we get to that, this all started in Irvine, California, which is right by you. What was it like being there while everything was going down?
Oh, man, this whole case has been absolutely insane. First, you had the murder of two basketball coaches, one from Cal State Fullerton, one from Concordia University here in Orange County. They were engaged to be married, and everybody was wondering. It just seemed like such a random death. Then a couple of days later, this manifesto starts popping up, and then you have like one of the biggest manhunts in Southern California history, and this guy, who, you know, Dorner, who seemed to evade all sorts of capture. And what a lot of people are getting upset about, though, of course, you know, the murders, the senseless murders of not just police officers, but innocent people.
Right.
But a lot of people are also upset that he has turned into a folk hero. You know, on the Mexican side of the world, the corridos, you know, Mexican ballads, they're being written in his honor. There's rap songs being written in Dorner's honors. You have all these memes, all these Facebook pages, and people really can't understand why. It's, first of all, it's part of American lore to go for the anti-hero. We have songs dedicated to Pretty Boy Floyd and Al Capone in the past. And more importantly, though, what Dorner, I'm not excusing his actions at all, but what he did was criticize a department that nowadays you can't criticize anymore. You really can't criticize the LAPD. They're always going to come out and say, hey, we're not like the LAPD of the past, so you should like us. But there's still so many stories of, if not out and out corruption like in the old days, there's still like the, you know, hey, somebody frisked me just because, you know, I was driving while black or driving while brown. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, Dorner tapped into this rage that is still prevalent here in Southern California.
See, and I appreciate that, Gustavo. But more than that, for me, when I was seeing a lot of the people kind of romanticizing his thing, it spoke to, for a lot of people of color, I think, that helpless feeling you feel when you've lost a job for no cause of your own. You feel like your name, the only thing you truly own, has been smeared. And you don't know what to do behind that. And I think a lot of people of color identify. And before we go much further, I gotta express my condolences to the families of the people,
of course,
that have been impacted by this. Essentially, I mean, he was a murderer. But a lot of people identify with that feeling of helplessness and hopelessness and not having anything to lose by trying to clear the only thing you have, you feel you have of value, which is your name. Also, this gets back to The first blaxploitation hero, Sweet Sweetback, shout out to Mario and Melvin Van Peebles, who famously was on the run after allegedly shooting a cop. So, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why Dorner's story got romanticized. But I think a lot of people just identify with that idea of, you know, keep trying to hold on to and save your good name. A-Train.
Yeah, I understand all of that, but I really have a problem with this growing concept of vigilante justice here in the United States. You know, Michelle and I were emailing back and forth this week, and, you know, there were Facebook groups that totaled over 7,000 people, you know, saying things
it's
like...
It's up to 24,000 now.
Yeah, I mean, wow. Saying things like, you know, we support Chris Dorner and things like that. And, you know, as Gustavo mentioned... You know, two of the first people that were murdered by Dorner were Monica Kwan and her fiancé, Keith Lawrence, in their car in their apartment complex because Dorner didn't like the way that Monica Kwan's father treated him in the police department. And I think that, you know, the more we lionize, you know, vigilante murderers, it really is a slippery slope in terms of, you know, the next time, you know, somebody quote-unquote goes postal in a workplace because of a grievance they might have had. And, you know, people who talk about, you know, they like Dorner because he was quote-unquote fighting the power, there are other ways to fight the power than committing murder.
But this isn't limited to the left. I mean, the fact is, or people who sort of, or the minority community, I mean, what about the guy who flew a plane into the IRS?
Joe Stack.
Into the satellite office
in Austin.
And Austin, and you know, a member of Congress expressed, you know, sympathy for him and said that he understood his, you know, grievance and stuff. What about the fact that, you know, another member of Congress invited Ted Nugent, who's, you know, a rocker and whatever, made these comments implying that, you know, violence was an appropriate way to express disagreement with President Obama's policies that he didn't like. And he was invited as a guest of this member of Congress to sit in the Congressional Gallery during the State of the Union, even after the Secret Service had a little chat with him about what he said. So I guess what I'm saying, maybe we just, you know, forgive me, Dr. Minkoff, maybe you want to talk about this. America, maybe just there's a certain portion of America that just loves crazy.
Well, I was going to go a slightly different way, and I was going to say that I think that we need to pull the politics as much as possible out of this, because it's clear that there's a certain level of person where it doesn't really matter what the provocation is and which direction it's coming from. They're going to have these outsized reactions. What I think is fascinating is the fact that Twitter and Facebook and the internet have given the people who support that anti-heroism a home. I mean, back in the day, Charlie Manson used to get fan letters and marriage proposals by mail, but they couldn't form a community. Now these people can form a community, and once they form one, they get more people joining, which is how it jumps from 7,000 to 24.
That's an interesting point. But can I just ask you this, though? Does, for the people who have legitimate grievances against the LAPD, and I have no way of knowing how widespread they are, how legitimate they are, does this do more harm than good?
Well, I think so.
I'm asking Neil, what do you think?
I mean, I think it does, and I think it gets to what the spokesman said in the clip that you played, which is, we're not going to open this to find out what happened. We're going to open this to show that nothing happened.
But why is that? How is that justice, though?
Oh, I'm not saying it is, but I'm saying the opposite. I'm saying that what this is doing is putting the walls up even higher and giving people in power an opportunity to do more to cover up.
Right.
What does Gustavo think about this?
I really think Dorner messed up hugely, not just in the murders, but even in his action. If he wanted to be this vigilante, you know, trying to go against the LAPD, that's the worst possible action he could have done. I wish Dorner, if he had grievances, that he would have gone to the media. He lived in Orange County. You know, we're the editor. We're famous in our community for going after corrupt cops. And although that's the LAPD, we would have taken those allegations seriously just because we know how police institutions run. We know what happens to whistleblowers within police departments. Killing people is not the way to fight the power,
right?
Because, you know, if you want to take that really leftist paranoid perspective, then the power is just going to clamp down even more on you. You have to be upfront. Like organizations like Cop Watch, you know, that are always exposing police corruption or, you know, police brutality. That's what you need to do, not killing people. That's just horrible.
I totally, absolutely, he should have went to the media, Gustavo. But, you know, the media could not have given him back his good name. And again, I'm not justifying what he did. I'm just saying.
Why can't they? Yeah. Whistleblower? What are you talking about?
You
all kinds of whistleblowers.
I get what Jimmy's saying.
You can file defamation lawsuits. You can file false light falsehoods. You can, you know, file civil rights claims. I mean, there are a lot of legal recourses that people can take. And I think that in this light, you know, the LAPD is going to have a little bit of political buffer now in the future because of the fact that, you know, this whole, you know, escapade happened.
Well, isn't the media the only thing that does give you back your good name, in essence?
I would disagree with that.
Well, okay. If you're just joining us, we're having our weekly visit to the barbershop. We're joined by writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, National Review contributor Neil Minkoff. He's also trained as a primary care physician and author and columnist Gustavo Arellano. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Well, the Dorner chase kind of, or it certainly threatened to overshadow the other big story earlier this week, President Obama's State of the Union speech. He outlined a lot of big plans, as usual, including raising the minimum wage $9 an hour, but not everybody was clapping.
No.
We got some tape, right?
No, this is actually, it's interesting. This is one of the things that I think I'm getting a lot of the most mail about, pro and con, this week, even though there are a number of other things in the speech, obviously. He argued that this is necessary to keep up with the cost of living expenses. This is what Republican House Speaker John Boehner had to say about it.
When you raise the price of employment, guess what happens? You get less of it. At a time when the American people are still asking the question, where are the jobs, why would we want to make it harder for small employers to hire people?
Well, I know why he didn't just quote my mom. You can't get blood from a turnip.
Right.
It always works.
There's that. You mean, to me, thank you for that, Michelle. And for me, it just occurs to me as a pacifier. I'm sorry, as a Band-Aid and a pacifier. A-Train, I'm sure as the Obama supporter of the group, you feel differently. Does the speaker have a point?
Well, first of all, let me finish awkwardly drinking my water like my name was Marco Rubio.
you know, I was going to make that joke.
I'm not Latino here. I should have done that.
There's a big difference. I think people need to understand. You know, there's a big difference between a minimum wage and a living wage. A living wage, you know, most countries have found is the minimum income that you can make, that you should make in order to be able to pay rent and groceries and things like that.
Right.
You know, right now, the minimum wage worker makes about $14,500 a year, which is below the poverty level. There was a joint letter that was signed onto by former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich and Nobel laureate in economics Joseph Stiglitz, which actually said that increasing the minimum wage has little or no negative effect on the employment of minimum wage workers, and that actually it could raise demand and job growth. And so I think what we're seeing here is a lot of politics being played. You know, there was a study done in 2011 which showed that if Walmart paid all 1.4 million of their employees a living wage of $12 an hour, that would only result in customers, and every penny was passed on to the customer, it would result in only a 46 cent per trip increase for $12 a year. And we all know that people save a lot more than $12 a year at Walmart.
All right, Neil, what do you think?
Well, I mean, this is one of those issues where I think you kind of break down to core beliefs. And there's, you know, for the study that was just quoted, you know, there's Professor Newmark at the University of California at Irvine, who has spent, you know, years studying this and come to the exact opposite conclusion. And I don't pretend to be enough of an economist to know which one is correct. I know that I kind of have a gut reaction that my, you know, stuff that's more expensive is more expensive and therefore becomes more scarce. You know, I think that the what I would prefer, frankly, is if we're talking about the cost of living adjustment, what can we do to make the cost of living go down? And the cost of living is up because of a whole bunch of things. And one of them is, for example, energy prices that are as high as they've ever been. I'd prefer to reduce the cost of living than to go after the wage.
Gustavo, your column is Ask a Mexican, so I guess I'm going to have to do that. You know, I mean, I know the minimum wage in Cali is like $8. You know, is a dollar going to make a whole lot of difference?
Yeah, I mean, us Mexicans, we know how to live frugally and with next to no money. All of that said, I think it worries me that Obama – I mean, I think it's very telling of where we are as a country right now that Obama's focusing on raising the minimum wage. That shows that there's a lot of people making the minimum wage, which for me is very worrisome as a nation. We, you know, as Neil was saying, we need something that not only is going to lower the cost of living down. I mean, gas prices right now, they've been on the rise for 25 straight days here in Southern California. We're paying, I think, was it $4.50 a gallon right now? It's impossible. Mm. And at the same, it's horrible. But at the same time, you know, we need better jobs that are going to give, instead of minimum wage jobs, we need jobs that are going to be able to get people not $9 an hour or even $8 an hour, but $12, 15 hours, that living wage increase. Out here, the unions, whenever they negotiate with, you know, with their contractors, they're not getting minimum wage. They're saying we need a living wage. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to push everyone immediately into the middle class, but we can't have them living in poverty, especially given how high cost of living is today. So for a moment to focus on that, that worries me.
I have a theory. And my theory is that this is really about jawboning the business community, which has been doing extremely well and over the last couple of years. I mean, people call it the Obama bull market. I think he's jawboning the business community to spread some of that money around.
Well, and also,
I don't think he's about. No, that's my theory.
Well, and most people don't realize that the federal minimum wage has not been raised in 3 years. And for the first time, President Obama is actually saying that we should also increase the minimum wage for tipped workers, so waiters, waitresses, baristas, which hasn't been changed in 20 years. Mm-hmm. You know, and so as the standard of living continues to go up, you know, low income wage earners' wages have remained virtually stagnant and not even indexed for inflation, which it would be after the $9 increase.
You know, one thing, I'm a big critic of Obama, but I'm happy to see he's got poor people on the agenda. Now, that made his stock go up in the Israel House, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's true.
Before we let you go, you know, it's been a sad week for wrestlers. It's a good week for LeBron fans. The International Olympic Committee, or the IOC, announced this week that they are eliminating wrestling beginning at 2020 on the approved list of sports. Those handball, sailing, table tennis, and badminton. I know you're a fan, Jimmy, of badminton in particular. How sad are you? But on the upside, LeBron is in the history books now, and it will be appearing at the NBA All-Star game this weekend. So which of those things is most important to you, Jimmy? I'll just ask you this question. The sadness about wrestling or LeBron victorious, showing that he really is King James?
Well, I mean, he always was King James to the extent that, I mean, he brings the ability and the demeanor to be a champion. Whatever his personality is whatever. But I'm certainly happy about that.
I was going to give Arslan 10 seconds to rep the Celtics, but sorry, we cannot.
Sorry. Kobe.
Jimmy Israel's a writer and culture critic. He's an adjunct professor of film at social media at Cuyahoga Community College. Gustavo Arellano is the author of Taco USA and the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. Neil Minkoff is a contributor to the National Review, and he's also founder of Fountainhead Healthcare. Arslan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney and founder of themuslimguide.com. Thank you all so much.
Peace.
Thank you, everyone.
Gracias.
Yep.
And remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast in the iTunes store or at npr.org. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.